Thanks very much, Kevin. It's very nice to be here, and thanks to Finzia for the invitation to speak here today. I'm going to try to address the questions that were posed in the agenda for today's meeting, and that means that I'm going to be talking about the size of the Australian financial system, its growth, what's happened over the last quarter century or so, and the question of whether it can continue. Has the world changed completely since the GFC, and in what ways? I'm going to tackle those questions by, first of all, taking a bit of a retrospective on what happened to the Australian financial system. By the middle of last decade, and roughly speaking, it stayed flat at that level since then. That's the big picture story. So banking has become, banking services have become more widely available at a lower cost to customers. I think the nature of competition has also changed. In the regulated environment, banks, because customers weren't very mobile, banks tended to compete on a whole of institution basis, and there were some very big cross subsidies built into the pricing system. So you had very wide interest margins, which tended to cross subsidise other services of banks, particularly payment services. As competition developed, cross subsidies were attacked, margins came down, you tended to get competition developing on a product-by-product basis rather than at the level of institutions as a whole. I want to come back to that point when I conclude briefly at the end. But what I've said so far has been to summarise very briefly what I see as the two very big things that have changed over roughly the quarter century leading up to the GFC. Now, what were the factors that were driving that? Well, I think we can divide those factors up into three groups. And the first group I think of as the longer-run forces, which are largely independent of one-off events or cyclical events, and which therefore we could expect to continue. And those long-run factors have to do with the growth of incomes, with technology, and with demographics. As people get richer, you would expect them to be able to spend more of their income on financial services and other non-necessities as they spend less on necessities. And I think we've seen that over time. People are able to spend more on debt servicing to buy scarce assets, and so the value of scarce assets tends to rise relative to incomes over time. We've seen those things happening. Technology is improving. The financial sector is an information technology intensive industry, and as the technology improves, you would expect that productivity is improving, and that's a supply expansion, and take that in conjunction with the demand expansion that I've already talked about, and you've got a recipe for ongoing growth of the sector. So those are the long-run factors that I think have driven and may continue to drive growth of the financial sector over time. But in my view, those weren't actually the main things that were driving the growth over the period of roughly a quarter century up to the GFC. The really big things are the things that I want to talk about next. And one of those was the effects of financial deregulation, and combined with that, the effects of the transition to low inflation and a low interest rate environment. I've already made the point, and it's very obvious to everyone here, that financial deregulation increased the availability of credit by removing artificial constraints. In addition to that, though, the adjustment to deregulation was taking place at a time when countries around the world, and including Australia, got inflation down to low single digits, and they got their interest rate structures down in a way that was commensurate with that. if you factor that in to the borrowing capacity of an ordinary household taking out a mortgage, you can see that their borrowing capacity is going to have gone up very substantially. One very rough calculation, if you take a 25-year mortgage and assume a 30% repayment ratio on that, and you take the movement in interest rates between the late 80s and, say, 10 years ago, well, the average household's capacity to borrow is going to have gone up from roughly 2 times annual income to something like 4 times annual income. If you couple that with just the increased availability of credit because of the reduced regulatory constraints, and you've already got a set of factors that's going to go a long way towards explaining the increase in credit and debt over the period, roughly 25 years leading up to the GFC. But the thing to remember about all of that is these were one-off factors, and it now looks as though they have largely run their course, or perhaps even more than fully run their course, as the system has now had plenty of time to adjust. That brings me to my third set of factors, which I think have also been important in explaining financial developments over this lengthy period, and that is the dynamic interaction between credit and debt. I think it's a well-documented fact that financial sectors have the capacity to, at certain periods of time, overdo credit expansion. They do that through processes of self-fulfilling expectations, what Alan Greenspan called irrational exuberance. And these things, for a while, can feed on themselves and generate the kind of optimism that gets people to borrow more than they can really afford. In a typical financial bubble, you see elements of outright irresponsibility, dishonesty and fraud piggybacking on the general exuberance. And I think around the world, in the GFC period, we saw plenty of those sorts of things going on. But I think we can also ask the question, over a longer time scale, over maybe a 25-year time scale, did the financial sector around the world overexpand? Is it now too big relative to the real economy? And does that mean that we are now in for a period of readjustment where the financial sector globally has to resume a more realistic relative place in the economy? I raise that question because I think it's a very important one, but it's also a question that it's very hard to be definitive about. What I want to do is just make a few observations that I think are relevant to that question. One point I think we can make is that in particular instances and in particular countries, it does seem clear that financial sectors overexpanded relative to the economy. We've all seen the news about Cyprus in the papers this week, and one of the stylized facts that's being talked about in the Cyprus case is that the banking system grew to a point where its total assets were about 8 times national GDP. That is a very large number by the standards of international experience and historical experience. And it's interesting to note that there were a few other recent examples where banking assets to GDP got up to those sorts of numbers. In Ireland and Iceland, for example, those numbers got up to around 7 and around 9. And even in a country like the UK, that ratio got up to 5 times GDP. All of those numbers are big compared to historical and international experience. And it is interesting to note, I think, that the countries where these ratios got particularly high are among the countries that experienced the most severe stress and which are now undergoing significant periods of consolidation as people can see that they've been overexposed to debt. In Australia's case, the same ratio, and I want to stress here, it's a very crude measure, and I'm not saying it's the only measure or it's the scientific way to judge these things, But in Australia's case, the ratio of banking assets to GDP was a much more modest 2 times. And so our experience has been very different from the experience of other countries. And I think to the extent that there is a generalised overhang of financial expansion around the world, it's much less likely to be an issue here in Australia than it is elsewhere. But all of that brings me back to the original question that I set out to address, which is what are the prospects for further expansion of the Australian financial system from here on? And I think to give a summary answer to that, the best I can do is to go back to the 3 causal factors that I outlined earlier. Those factors were, first of all, the long-run forces, which tell you that because of income growth and technology improvement, there are some good reasons to think financial sectors can grow over time relative to GDP. So that factor is always there lurking in the background. However, I think it's also the case that a good deal of the actual expansion that happened in Australia over the 25 years leading up to the GFC was actually driven by one-off factors, particularly related to financial deregulation and the transition to low interest rates. And then thirdly, there is this other issue, which I think is a global issue, of whether financial systems generally expanded too much, and the question of whether there needs to be some readjustment to bring financial sectors back to a realistic size relative to the overall economy. And as I said, I think that's mainly an issue for the countries where those expansions really were most pronounced, and I mentioned some of those countries earlier. My final summary message, I think I can state in 2 points. First of all, looking forward, I think we're going to be in an environment for the foreseeable future where it's harder for banks to grow than it was in the past. We shouldn't expect, and banks shouldn't expect, double-digit credit growth, which did seem to be a norm for quite a long time, and probably they shouldn't expect consistent growth in credit and bank balance sheets in excess of the growth of the nominal economy. The second summary thing that I want to finish up on concerns the nature of competition. I talked a bit earlier about how deregulation increased the amount of competition and it also changed the nature of it. And I think the post-GFC environment has made a further very important change in the nature of competition that banks face. Pre-GFC, funding for banks was very easily available at what I would call elastic price conditions. And so the business challenge for banks was all about using the available funding and working out what's the best risk-adjusted way of lending that out to good customers. In the post-GFC environment, I think the challenge for banks is somewhat different because investors now are much more discerning about risk. We've seen that in wholesale markets. It's also true, I think, in deposit markets that we're seeing a lot of price sensitivity and strong competition for deposits. And I think what that's done is it's created a new environment where banks need to compete on both sides of their balance sheet. They're competing hard for deposits, and that's good for the depositors. And there's also the existing competition process going on the lending side, looking for good risk-adjusted returns in their loans to customers. So I see this two-sided competition configuration as a good thing because it means that banks themselves are going to be under stronger pressure than they used to be to manage their risks, and that's got to be a good thing for financial stability going forward. Of course, that's also something that regulators are going to be very focused on and will be seeking to do their part in as well. But thanks very much.
Hi there, Dr. Laker. I was interested, and also Mr. Eddy, the US Fed and other central banks are increasing their supply of money, which is creating the sort of liquidity that we had pre the GFC. I'm just interested in what, and it, flying on from that, if you talk to local banks here, they say particularly US banks are coming here and refinancing corporate loans that they say sort of pre-GFC type credit, or you know, lack of credit restrictions. And I was just wondering from where you both stood, what level of concern you have about credit standards falling, and if so, what you can do about it.
There's a lot of talk about the impact of quantitative easing in countries around the world that are doing this, and the US obviously is a leading example of it. People are asking questions as to whether there's a risk of overstimulus or what are the risks associated with eventually withdrawing the stimulus. I think these are interesting things to focus on, but the discussion around these things does tend to draw a certain amount of unjustified alarmism. I think, generally speaking, the US and various other countries reached quite some time ago a point where they couldn't stimulate their economies through conventional means, and they took the understandable step to move into various instruments of quantitative easing. I think when people raise concerns about this, part of what they're really saying is these things are actually having an effect. Because part of the expected effect of monetary easing is that you expect people to take a bit more risk financially. Because if you think back over the GFC period, a big part of what was going on was not just a retreat from risk, but an absolute panic where people were not prepared to take any risk at all. So I think in general, the shift towards quantitative easing across a range of countries has been understandable. At some point they're going to have to withdraw that, but I think we shouldn't be getting ourselves into a panic about what that's going to look like just yet either.
Hi, gentlemen. Patrick Durkin from the Australian Financial Review. Just a question for Malcolm and John and the rest of the panel. Shane mentioned a son or daughter of Wallace inquiry. I'm just wondering whether you think that's something that Joe Hockey and the opposition have talked about. Is there much appetite or need for such an inquiry, or is the industry a little fatigued of so much regulation?
I don't know why you asked me first. I can't really get into that. I mean, if a government wants to have an inquiry into the financial system, they're perfectly entitled to do so. And it's very hard to comment preemptively about what might or might not be involved in that.